This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls later at 866-439-5277. You can also email talk at larslarson.com. It is a great pleasure to welcome back to the program after too long an absence because he's been busy writing best-selling books. You'll remember him for Black Hawk Down, but of course there are 12 other books in addition to Black Hawk Down. And he is the author-in-residence at, this is what I read in the trivia, that you're an author-in-residence at Delaware University, Mr. Bowden?
University of Delaware, yeah. I just left that position, but I've been there for about the last 6 years.
Does that mean they just park you in an office and let you write and not have to teach classes or do anything else?
No. I was teaching classes, and I enjoyed it very much, but I decided to move away from it and concentrate on the writing now.
Now, I'm not that old. I mean, I'm 58, but I remember Vietnam as a teenager in a middle school or a junior high school student, but I've been getting a kick out of showing this book to some of my younger colleagues and saying, what do you think of this book? And they say, Hugh? And I say, no, it's Huey. And we all knew Huey, even as a teenager, I knew what Huey was. And I knew,
right.
I didn't know the story, as you've told it, in Huey's 1968. It's being described as a fantastic accomplishment of journalism to write about something that happened that long ago, but was so significant to the entire course of the Vietnam War. So would you please set the scene for my audience?
Sure. I remember all this well. I was a teenager in high school when this happened, and I think everybody who was, reading and thinking at the time, was acutely aware of what was going on. But the United States had entered the war in Vietnam directly in 1965, beginning to send combat troops and engaging in direct fighting with the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. And in the 3 years from 1965 to 1968, they had dealt substantial blows to the enemy, but the war had reached a kind of stalemate. At the same time, the American command, personified by General William Westmoreland, had been assuring the president and the American people that the United States was winning the war handily and that we were, in fact, going to be able to start withdrawing troops in 1968. And then came the Tet Offensive in January of 1968, where the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong launched simultaneous attacks on more than 100 cities and towns in South Vietnam, a demonstration of force and capability that shocked the world. The biggest thing that they did was to take over the city of Hue, which was the third largest city in South Vietnam. And the story that I tell in Hue 1968 is about the battle that was waged for nearly a month by American forces and South Vietnamese forces to take back the city of Hue. In some ways, I found, that this single battle, which was the bloodiest of the war, encapsulates a lot of the story of the whole Vietnam era.
Now, they caught the Americans somewhat unaware because, explain the significance of Tet.
Well, Tet is the most significant holiday in Vietnam and, frankly, in Southeast Asia. It's the Lunar New Year. And traditionally, it's celebrated by taking, days or even a week off. Families get together for feasting and honoring their ancestors. So the whole country kind of comes to a stop. And in the years prior to 1968, it was the one time of year when the war even came to a stop. So South Vietnamese armed forces gave many of their troops a furlough over those days, and there was, in fact, supposedly a truce, which the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong ignored, and I think it helped them achieve surprise all over the country. That said, I think it was even more remarkable that they were able to amass the kind of forces that they did throughout South Vietnam, something that I don't believe the American command or the South Vietnamese military believed was possible.
I'm talking to Mark Bowden, who's the author most recently of Hue 1968, A Turning Point in the American War in Vietnam. Can you explain You touched on it a moment ago, but can you explain how it was that the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were able to anticipate that they could pull off this kind of victory against the, I guess, overwhelming might? We would think of it as the overwhelming might and the overwhelming intelligence capabilities and everything else that the United States had on its side.
Well, I don't think, frankly, Lars, that the North Vietnam was intimidated by the American forces. It's certainly true that America could deliver more firepower more rapidly anywhere in the battlefield than they could, and had far superior weapons and an endless stream of resupply. But they had advantages of their own, and that is that there was tremendous popular support for their movement, particularly in the rural areas, in the areas outside of South Vietnam's big cities. And I think they, you know, and they were also, frankly, more experienced infantry than the American forces. Most Americans who fought in Vietnam went over there for a year or a year and a month and marked their calendars until they came home, whereas the Vietnamese who were fighting, many of them had been fighting for generations. They'd fought against the French. They'd fought against the Chinese. The Americans were just the newest enemy. So they had a tremendous amount of experience. They were very competent as infantry forces. And they also believed they had a measure of popular support which could keep their movements secret.
Did the American commanders recognize that superiority?
No, they didn't. You know, it's one of the big failings of our military in Vietnam, which was to consistently underestimate the capability of the enemy. The ability of Hanoi to move men and material down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which was a jungle trail in the western part of the country, often crossing over into Laos. You know, I think the United States didn't believe them capable of moving so many men, so many supplies, but they were an extremely resourceful army, and they, you know, demonstrated in Hue in particular how effective they could be.
So tell me about Gulf Company and Gulf Company's initial mission. Go in, check this out, find out where we stand.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem, and you know, when we talk about an intelligence failure, we're not just talking, Lars, about the ability of the North Vietnamese to take over the city of Hue. That intelligence failure included a refusal, frankly, to believe that the enemy was in Hue in such numbers or in such force. So the initial foray into Hue was made by a company, just a company, which is maybe 150 men, who were dispatched Marines from Phu Bai, a military base like 10 miles south of the city, and told to go up into Hue and clean it out, attack the citadel and reinforce the besieged Arvin troops and clear up the problem. And they ended up, you know, marching into 10,000 guns, which was a catastrophic thing, obviously, for Gulf Company. But, you know, weirdly, you know, failed to even make a dent in the command's perception of what was going on.
You're hearing the voice of Mark Bowden, who is the author most recently of Hue 1968, the author of many other great books. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. You can follow on Twitter at Lars Larson Show. My guest is Mark Bowden, who is the author of Hue 1968, A Turning Point in the American War in Vietnam. So Gulf Company is told, 140 or 150 men are told, go in, figure this out, kick these people out. We're assuming it's a very small force. What did they run up against?
Well, Captain Chuck Meadows, who was commander of Gulf Company, was ordered to leave the small compound that the American forces had in Southern Hue and march up to the Citadel, which is this enormous fortress, which is basically all of the northern part of Hue is enclosed in this 19th century fortress, which is really quite a formidable thing. And they had to run across a bridge over the Huang River and launch an attack on the citadel. Well, what they were doing was, you know, launching an attack with, at that point, they probably had fewer than 100 men against literally thousands of dug-in North Vietnamese and Viet Cong who were capable of focusing deadly fire on the bridge that they had to cross. And then the citadel itself, you know, is constructed for defense. The only way in was over a very narrow bridge through one of the nine gates to the citadel. So once Captain Meadows and his men, those of them who survived, made it across the bridge, they faced, you know, 30-foot-high walls with hundreds of enemy soldiers firing down on them with machine guns and rifles. And, you know, Captain Meadows, who had lost a half or more of his company in crossing the bridge, quickly realized that this was insane. And so he took it on himself to try to withdraw, made his way back, those of them who survived, to the embattled compound, only to be ordered to go back out and fight their way across the city to try to preserve the remaining Arvin forces at a prison in Southern Hue. It was an idiotic order, and ultimately they refused to do it and were accused of cowardice and timidity. But it all stemmed from a refusal of the command in Phu Bai and in Saigon to believe the reports that Captain Meadows and other field commanders were sending them from Hue.
Was that perhaps part of the problem that the Americans are having, that when people who were on the front lines were sending information back, that because, as you pointed out, there were so many people there who were relatively green on the ground and didn't stay long, that their commanders just routinely didn't believe what the frontline troops were telling them?
You know, I think that is true. And, you know, and I think, Lars, that, you know, my understanding of General Westmoreland, which obviously deepened researching and writing this book, was that, you know, his major flaw as a commander was that he was so wedded to his theory of what was going on in the war and of the battlefield that the facts, you know, were, he was impervious to facts. So, you know, when field commanders would complain that the tactics that they were using didn't work, you know, they very frequently were dismissed as whiners or as cowards. You know, the idea that the United States military could not readily sweep all things before it, and that the army of what Lyndon Johnson called a podunk little pissant country, you know, could somehow fight American forces successfully was just impossible for them to believe. And so this really, I think, is illustrated profoundly and frankly, catastrophically in the Battle of Hue.
The book is called Hue 1968. Its author is Mark Bowden. So Westmoreland, you write, was convinced that whatever was going on elsewhere was a distraction, and it was designed to distract attention away from Khe Sanh, where he thought the real battle was going to come. But isn't it a famous adage among the military that no plan ever survives the first contact with the enemy, that you have to change and adapt? And or did that come after America's experience in Vietnam?
No, I think, Lars, you're right. It's one of the oldest adages in military tactics and strategy, and that is you have to have current intelligence and you have to adapt and adjust accordingly. The problem, I think, of the American command in Vietnam was arrogance, and it was born out of the successes in the World War II and in Korea, where you had an entire generation of American senior commanders who had known nothing but overwhelming power and overwhelming success. And I think the idea that they would not be able to swiftly defeat a, you know, guerrilla movement in the southern part of Vietnam was just an impossibility. They refused to believe it until it actually happened.
Well, but you mentioned Korea. What, Korea was a bloodbath, and did we not learn from that sometimes the overwhelming power and superiority didn't get you farther than a stalemate and an armistice?
Yes, I think, Lars, that's true. But you recall China intervened in the Korean War. Essentially, the way that war unfolded was that North Korea successfully invaded the South and very nearly took the whole country until General MacArthur landed American troops at Inchon behind their lines and very, I think, brilliantly maneuvered them back to the back into the north. And at that point, the Chinese poured across the border. So you were fighting a much larger army and a much more powerful force than what North Korea brought to the field. So, yes, it was very, very bloody, and it ended up in a standoff. But General MacArthur had turned back the invasion of the South, had secured South Korea, and I think it was regarded by most Americans as a successful military operation.
Mark, was there a point at which General Westmoreland came to realize the scope of what he was dealing with at Hue?
I think he had to realize it at a certain point because he lost so many men. And, you know, the people who were closer to the fighting, you know, had a certain amount of power to be making changes. I do know that General Westmoreland's number two man, Creighton Abrams, personally visited the, you know, the army divisions just north of the city at a certain point about 2 weeks into the battle and essentially gave them a blank check for whatever forces they needed to, you know, finish off the fight in Hue. But that came very late in the game. And, you know, frankly, Westmoreland himself, even in the years after the war in Vietnam, never acknowledged the successes that the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong had in Hue. I think I mentioned in his memoirs, which run to like 500 pages, he devotes all of about two or three pages to the Tet Offensive and the Battle of Hue, which was arguably the largest and most significant battle fought under his command.
And did he acknowledge that his early decisions in that were flawed, as you suggest?
No. And he did acknowledge years later that the takeover of Hue and the Tet Offensive as a whole had taken the American forces by surprise.
Mark Bowden is my guest. His latest book is Hue 1968. He is, of course, a reporter by trade and now continues his journalism in book form. 13 New York Times bestsellers, including the famous Black Hawk Down. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll talk about how reporters covered this offensive. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. My guest is Mark Bowden, the author most recently of Hue 1968, a turning point in the American war in Vietnam. And as a reporter, you had to appreciate, when you went back and did this research, the work of people like Gene Roberts, the man who was had just been appointed, I guess, by the New York Times as its Saigon bureau chief. What was covering this like for reporters?
Well, I have to say, you know, I had known Gene as an editor. He hired me years ago at the Philadelphia Inquirer, but I didn't really know about his work as a reporter. And I've done a lot of work as a foreign correspondent, and I've been in war zones as a journalist, so I know how difficult it is to sort of parachute into a confusing and dangerous situation and try to figure out from an overview what's going on. You know, Gene was the first reporter on the scene in Hue on the day that the city fell, and the official story coming out of Saigon was that there was no significant fighting in Hue. There was a small number of enemy forces who were in the city in various places that were being routed by American troops. And Gene landed in this small outpost in southern Hue, which took up about maybe two city blocks, and realized within a few hours that it was completely surrounded. And he would witness Marines trying to fight their way out to try to rescue Americans who had been trapped by the takeover of the city. And these forces would make it only like a block or a half a block and would come reeling back into the compound carrying their dead and wounded. So it occurred to him, and I think it was remarkable that he was able to put this together, but he realized fairly quickly that the city had fallen, that the enemy had occupied it, and that the American forces were vastly outnumbered and surrounded. And that was, as I said, a story that he managed to get out to the New York Times the next day that completely contradicted all of the official accounts of what was going on.
Let me ask you about that, and I want to get your perspective on how things have changed, because in the second Gulf War, we got used to rolling video live shots, green screen live shots coming out of the second Gulf War, where Americans could watch in real time as battles took place and as troops rolled across the country. But in those days, to get his story out, what did he have to do?
Well, that was, you know, one of the features of Vietnam was that the press was basically given free rein. They could hop military transport anywhere they wanted to go in the country. And so for Gene, you know, to get to Hue, he initially went to Da Nang thinking that there was a lot of fighting there, and there really wasn't. And he was told by troops in Da Nang that there was a big fight going on in Hue. So he got on a helicopter and flew to Phu Bai, the staging area south of the city of Hue, and then flew in on another helicopter with one of the first, actually it was the second company of Marines, part of the first battalion that included the Gulf Company. He flew in on the choppers that delivered them into the middle of the city, and he was essentially running through the streets with Marines under fire until they regrouped at this small compound. And from there, you know, he could go out with whatever, you know, forces were trying to fight their way out of the compound. His goal, of course, was not to fight, but to try to understand what was going on. And I think, you know, he was very brave to do it, and he was really smart about it because he figured out what was going on.
That takes a tremendous amount of courage, doesn't it?
It does, you know, and it's a level of dedication to journalism and reporting that thankfully few of us are called upon to demonstrate. But, you know, it's part of Gene's whole attitude toward journalism and reporting, which I was lucky enough to be exposed to in my years working for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and that is you go out and find the story. You don't read about it online, or you don't read wire reports and believe everything you hear. You actually go where the story is happening, and you pay attention, and sometimes you put yourself at risk in order to figure out what's really happening.
I'm talking to Mark Bowden, who's the author most recently of Hue 1968, a mammoth book about that battle and about the Tet Offensive. Would you mind, before we leave journalism altogether, I want to ask you a couple of things. First, would you mind telling the story of Catherine Leroy and Francois Mazur, these two French journalists?
Yes, you know, it's amusing and also scary, but Catherine Leroy was this diminutive French woman who, with her companion, you know, made their way to Hue, arriving, I believe, it was the 2 days after Roberts had gotten there. And because the French, you know, had been the longtime colonial masters of Vietnam and were not fighting in the war in Vietnam alongside Americans, they were perceived or hoped to be perceived as sort of neutrals in the conflict. So Catherine rode into Hue on a convoy of Marines and then got off the truck and bicycled into the city on her own, ended up falling into the hands of the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong, who surprisingly let her take pictures. So she, you know, got all these pictures of the North Vietnamese troops and the Viet Cong troops, which subsequently ran on the cover of Life magazine, like about a week later, and then was lucky enough to find her way back to the American side. So, you know, another example of an extraordinarily brave, you know, sometimes bravery borders on foolishness, but nevertheless, you know, her reporting was honest and gave Americans a glimpse of what we were fighting.
Well, let me ask you about that. She saw herself as French and therefore neutral, but the French have history in Vietnam as well.
They did. But, you know, there was, you know, I think that the attitudes of many Vietnamese, particularly in South Vietnam at that time, were relatively friendly toward the French. The culture, the French culture had really made a big impact on South Vietnam. A lot of South Vietnamese spoke French. And I think, particularly in a city the size of Hue, which was a place where there were many educated people, it was the home of Hue University, and it was an intellectual center in South Vietnam. You know, there would certainly have been an understanding that the French were not adversaries at that point. This was what a decade or more after the French had left Vietnam. So I think that there were reasonable expectations that people would perceive them as being non-combatants and not allied with the American effort.
Mark, tell me what the reaction was back on the ground in the United States. So the New York Times runs these stories from Gene Roberts that says this is a bloodbath and that our troops are being chewed up on the ground in Hue. Meanwhile, Westmoreland is telling the reporters that he's talking to, and he made a lot of statements to the public, that things are going well and that this is not the main battle in the situation. So what was the reaction back at home to these contradictory reports?
Well, there's no doubt that the Tet Offensive was a tremendous shock to the American people. And that played out in a number of ways. It really ignited the anti-war movement in this country. For instance, it was that during that month that Senator Gene McCarthy's campaign to unseat President Johnson really took off. It definitely, I think, was a great blow to the credibility of General Westmoreland and President Johnson, who both had been assuring the American people that something like this could not happen. When it clearly did happen, it had a predictable effect on American public support for the war. And frankly, you know, I would argue that it was a time when America's trust in leadership, in our leaders, both civilian and military, began to seriously erode.
I'm talking to Mark Bowden, who's the author of Hue 1968, A Turning Point in the American War in Vietnam. So you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And Mark Bowden is with me, the author of it's 13 New York Times bestsellers. He is a former reporter, and he has most recently written Hue 1968. So we've talked about the fact that the North Vietnamese and the front managed to pull off somewhat of a popular uprising. They take Hue, and they have turned this into a death zone for American troops. But the folks behind this, you write in the book, knew that they couldn't hang on to Hue. So what was their real goal?
Well, you know, it's complicated, Lars. And, you know, it's definitely true that the North Vietnamese in Hanoi were just as vigorous in dispensing propaganda as the American command, if not more so. And, you know, they had every expectation, at least the propagandist, and a certain faction in the party believed that the people of South Vietnam would rise up and that this Tet Offensive would be the decisive blow in the war, that it would defeat the South Vietnamese government and it would chase Americans from the country. That said, there was a far more realistic element within the military and within the party, including Ho Chi Minh and General Giep, who was the famous commander who had defeated the French. They both understood correctly that it was unlikely that the South Vietnamese people would rise up in support of the revolution. And, you know, military leaders, certainly on the ground in and around Hue, knew that the American capability to counterattack and the South Vietnamese army would be irresistible, that there was no way that they could hold the city. In fact, most of them believed they couldn't really hold it for more than a couple of days. And in fact, they turned out to be more pessimistic than they needed to be, because while it was true that the South Vietnamese people did not rise up in support of the revolution, they were able actually to hang on to the city for nearly a month. And I would credit that in part to the inadequacy of the initial American response. This was not a situation where the American command stood back and said, okay, realistically, what's it going to take for us to get the city back, and then developed the strategy and tactics and force needed. It was more like a refusal to believe that it had happened. And as we discussed, sending small units in piecemeal, which had the effect of greatly increasing the casualty count for American troops, but also prolonging the time it took to take the city back.
Do you hear echoes of Hue in situations like Mosul today, or is that comparison inappropriate?
No, I think it's very appropriate, and I do think that it is. Vietnam has a lot of lessons to teach, and certainly one of them is that, you know, we live in a democracy, and any time the United States intervenes militarily around the world, a clock starts to tick There's a limited amount of time or tolerance that the American public has for fighting wars on a small scale around the world and for viewing and suffering American casualties in a conflict that, frankly, you know, most Americans feel very removed from and certainly don't feel threatened by. I think that, you know, the expectation that the United States military can go off on a foreign adventure and that they'll have the full enthusiastic backing of the American people is unrealistic. You know, I think if the country were attacked, if people were fighting for their lives, were fighting for, you know, the existence of their own country, you know, that obviously summons a deeper level of commitment than fighting a war in Iraq or fighting a war in Vietnam or anywhere else that we send troops.
I'm talking to Mark Bowden, who's the author most recently of Way 1968. I want to ask you about that. As you and I are talking, the week that we're talking, we're about 30 hours into the report that says that North Korea now has missiles that can reach the United States and nukes small enough to put in them. And I was reflecting on this with a couple of friends yesterday saying, look, this really, you know, for all these different conflicts we've been in over the decades, this now comes as close as we've come since the Cold War to Americans saying, gee, they have a weapon that can reach out and hit us here. Because all these other, as you say, wars or adventures or battles that we fight around the world are usually removed by thousands of miles in big oceans. How do you expect the American people might react to this? Because I don't see any great signs of alarm, you know, at the idea that North Korea could, if it chose, under the leadership of a man I think is a psychopath and not entirely rational, now has nukes that could reach out and hit Seattle or Los Angeles or other places in the United States. And yet I don't see the kind of alarm that I might expect when the bad guys can actually reach out and hit us right here at home.
Yeah, I think you're right, Lars. I think it remains and has been actually for some time a kind of abstract threat. You know, and I think it's also, given the logic of the Cold War, most people, I think, assume that North Korea would not be so suicidal as to launch a, you know, an attack on the United States. It would serve no point. And I do think, as you say, that it would be a completely irrational act. I disagree with you, and I think Kim Jong-un is a perfectly horrible person, and I think the regime over there is frankly pretty crazy. But I don't think he's irrational. I think he has very systematically consolidated his power ruthlessly, that he has basically set himself up at a fairly young age to be the dictator of that country for indefinitely. And I don't think someone like that is going to, for no apparent reason, commit suicide, which is what he would be doing if he launched an attack on Seoul or the United States.
You make a good case, although I've given up on trying to predict what he's going to do. I understand he wants to hold on to power, and I think he looks at Gaddafi as what happens when you give up power, that the United States might just decide to remove you. And in that, I think that's rational. But a guy who drops mortars on people who disagree with him or speak ill of him, he just seems a little tough to predict. His book is called Way 1968. It's a mammoth achievement. He is Mark Bowden, the author, also Black Hawk Down and a dozen other New York Times bestsellers. Mark, you've been very generous, and thank you so much for the time.
You're welcome, Lars. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. As you know, the Washington Post was the subject of an attempted sting by an organization called Project Veritas. And as I told you yesterday, when we learned about this, I said James O'Keefe, the founder of Project Veritas, has been on our show too many times to count. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if he tried to sting the venerable old Washington Post to show that they are suckers when it comes to fake news. James, it's good to have you back on the program.
Great. Hey, Lars, it's great to be back with you.
I don't want to speak for you, but did the Washington Post expose something that was an attempt to sting them? with some
fake
news?
I don't. We don't comment on investigations, real or imagined. We don't comment on things we haven't finished doing, things we haven't released yet. And that's just not something that I have ever done. I've never compromised my sources. I've never identified who my undercover journalists are. And that's just not something I'm going to start doing just because the entire media machine is trying to destroy us. We have released one video yesterday into the Washington Post, and we're about to release another. And I'm literally finishing touches. I'm actually going to put out a poll and a video identifying the people that we have on camera inside the Washington Post. So I'm not going to. I know you're probably going to keep asking, but I'm not.
Well,
going
no,
to,
I don't.
I'm
I don't,
not going to.
I don't like going over old ground. But no, I understand. And in effect, you've done just what I asked you to do, which is to say, was this an attempt to see whether the Washington Post would bite on this kind of thing? What are folks going to see if they go look up the YouTube video from Project Veritas about its investigation of the Washington Post?
Well, what we've released one video so far. Yesterday, we released some video of a reporter who was basically talking about how crazy the editorial page is. And this guy's name was Dan Lamothe. He's a serious national security correspondent. We released another video of a guy at the paper who worked with Jeff Bezos, who talks about Bezos' influence on the culture. And we're about to release another video. It may be in a few hours, it may be tomorrow morning, of one of the Post's very prominent people talking more about the paper's agenda and talking about how different what we hear and see versus what's actually happening. So it's not conspiratorial for me to argue. We have really, really riled up the hornet's nest, first on CNN. That embarrassed CNN badly, by the way.
Yep.
I was on your program. Next on the New York Times, that cost the New York Times reporter his job, and the executive editor changed their social media policy. And now we have these videos in the Washington Post. And undercover work is tricky. It's messy. It's tough. It's hard. I don't know of anyone else doing it. Do you?
No,
I don't.
I don't.
Of any other media company on the planet. So this is uncharted territory.
James, you know that one of the points I've made is that the kind of work you do used to be done by some reporters at some news organizations, both print and broadcast. And it isn't done much anymore. And the fact that you do it on a fairly short, short budget and short shoestring shows that it could be done by the networks, but they choose not to do it. And in fact, James, I'll have you understand this, that I anticipated that there would be people in journalism who would say, how dare you try to sting us with a false story? And my response to that would be, news organizations have been stinging politicians and private individuals and private companies with false stories for a long, long time to test whether or not they're getting the truth. And I applaud your efforts at Project Veritas to try to make sure that we get the truth from the mainstream media, because I think a lot of us believe that we're getting fake news, made up news to some extent, from broadcast and from cable television.
Yeah, and thank you for saying that. I mean, in the final analysis, it's not about techniques or methods or what we pose as or what we don't pose as. And honestly, I'm never going to. And they're staked out of my building right now. I've got national reporters. Everyone on the planet is trying to talk to me about what we do. I will never reveal the identity of my undercover people ever, no matter what. And if I do that, I sell my soul. That's what they want me to do because they want to destroy me. In the final analysis, it's really not about our methods or our techniques. Don't let them fool you about the morality and ethics crap, because they're willing to cross every line to get a story. This is about taking sides and whose side they think that you are on. Undercover work is hard. It's making sausages. Sometimes it's not pretty, but it's effective. And you know what? If we went after someone that their conscience deemed bad, they wouldn't care about going undercover and posing as whatever. It's all about the bottom line and about the narrative. That's all this is about. And that's what it's about. And that's why what we're doing at Project Veritas is so important, because nobody, and I mean nobody, has the guts, the willingness, the institutional background basis. We've crossed over the barriers to entry, and no one can stop us at this point. No one can stop us. Our supporters love it. They're excited about the next video.
I absolutely love it.
But there's a lot at stake here, and it really upsets me to see people who I thought were promoters of transparency and accountability trying to, I don't know, shut us down or shut us up.
Well, and James, when you bring up the ethics and the morality of it, think about what we've seen in the last 9 months here in the Trump administration, and that is you see news organizations that have published things in which national security data was released, names were unmasked, things that had been obtained possibly illegally through wiretaps and other surveillance of people has been released publicly. Apparently, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the big networks had no problem with the ethics and morality of releasing that stuff. But if it gets turned around and it makes them look foolish, then all of a sudden the major media says, well, it's just not ethical to do it that way. Well, baloney.
Yeah. If we investigate one of their enemies, we're their friend. If we investigate one of their friends, we're their enemy. It's all about what the nature of the subject you're investigating is, and that somehow determines the legitimacy or illegitimacy of the techniques. But, you know, I'm rereading The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and one of the things he says, the press, the media, has more power than the courts, Congress, anything else, the executive branch. The media has so much power in this country, and they've shamed so many people to justify their political ends that somebody has to do something about it. And this is sort of a war. And those of us who dwell within the media complex, you know, it's not just their jobs they're worried about, it's their power over the flow of money to them, their friends, their causes, their power over the elected, and the power they have over you and me. So yes, Project Veritas has its stone lodged between Goliath's eyes. Right now, we are at an inflection point. We're thinking, we need to take this guy down. We need to take this whole thing down because it's too close for comfort. They're changing the New York Times social media policy. They've embarrassed Jeff Zucker, and now they're going after Jeff Bezos. And let me just tell you one thing, Lars. Tomorrow, actually maybe even sooner than that, we have another video coming on the Washington Post.
I'm anxious for that because, James, the other thing I've noticed is that when you have gone out to investigate various organizations over the years, you don't tend to pick just one target. You go out and you look at multiple targets, you know, with the same technique at the same time. Should we assume that if your organization went out and tried to sting the Washington Post, that it might have been looking at other news organizations simultaneously in the same way?
Yeah, we have, I can't say the number of people, but right now as I speak, we have more people than you could probably imagine out there full-time working with us as undercover journalists all over the United States. And it just takes one. It just takes one massive story, like the ones we released on the New York Times, CNN, and the Hillary Clinton campaign, to change the game. And I'm not going to give you the names of these institutions, but we have people inside of them, and they're getting stuff, and they're getting deep.
That's James O'Keefe, the founder of Project Veritas. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. We'll get to that in a moment, but this is actually a very exciting development for me. Do you know about 20 years ago, I started talking to people on the air, both experts and callers, about what we could possibly do to diminish the number of illegal aliens in America and to try to stop them from having a negative economic impact on American workers. And one of the best ideas for doing that is E-Verify. Well, E-Verify has been available for a long, long time. The only question is, when are they going to make it mandatory that all American employers must use E-Verify to make sure that the workers they hire are actually working legally? Well, Tom Broadwater joins me now, president of Americans for Work, because it sounds like the Congress is right on the cusp of considering mandatory E-Verify for the whole country. Tom, welcome to the program, and tell us what you know.
Lars, thank you for having me. Thank you for allowing us to speak with you and your audiences there in Portland and across the United States. Yes, mandatory E-Verify could be a blessing for the American worker as we know them from 25 to into their 60s, and particularly for the constituent group that we represent, which are African Americans, Native Hispanic Americans, those from Puerto Rico and Cuba, et cetera, and veterans and our younger citizens who are seeking careers.
What's it going to take to get votes from both Democrats and Republicans? Because I would hope that even the Democrats would be on board with the idea of verifying all workers, because when illegal aliens take jobs, that hurts workers. And of course, the Democrats claim to be the champion of the little guy, the blue collar worker, although I don't think they are.
Well, I think that for most Americans, what would be most helpful is if they would look at this illegal immigration and overdone legal immigration as a nonpartisan issue. We are nonpartisan. We have little faith in the Democratic Party or the Republican Party to do the right thing. We think over time those two parties have become national corporations from which nothing gestates that's of any value, and into which anybody that goes becomes sort of a drone or a citizen of the corporation. So this is an independent, nonpartisan issue that Americans should embrace that way. And it says, look, this is hurting us, all of us, in the American economy. Illegal aliens who can saunter in and take municipal jobs, municipal benefits, hospital health care assurances, and everything else. And then legal aliens who are now using the chain migration process to bring in their cousin, their brother, and then the brother brings in his sister and everybody else. We're just being overrun with a process, with an exploitation of our weak immigration enforcement capability.
I'm talking to Tom Broadwater, who's president of Americans for Work. So let's give people a practical example. Arizona mandates E-Verify in 2008, about 9 years ago. What happened then?
I'm not sure what happened in Arizona, but I can tell you that Senator McCain has been a conformist and sort of a malleable politician seeking to find, as former President George W. Bush said, a compassionate conservatism. There is no compassion that any American should give to the presence and the destructive behavior of illegal immigrants, and also the proliferated legal immigrant community that we have in this country.
I mean,
it was never intended. The 1965 Act was created to diversify the types of people who would come into the country, but it was not introduced to multiply the numbers of people that come in. And that's, unfortunately, both that act has been exploited and our border has been exploited by illegals. The combination of too many legal immigrants and millions of illegal immigrants has devastated local economies nationwide, has put healthy, decent, hardworking American workers out of work.
Well, Tom, the thing I was referring to is that I frequently hear from callers who don't like my position on illegal aliens. They don't like the fact that I would like to see illegal aliens shown the door. I'd like them to come back to the country legally or don't come back at all. And they say, well, you can't get them to leave, number one. And number two, it really doesn't have an effect on wages. And I was looking at this effect that it had on Arizona, which we're told when they mandated E-Verify in 2008, the illegal alien population dropped 40% over the next 4 years. So when they found out they couldn't get jobs, they left. And that the average low-skilled native-born worker saw annual wages rise by $5,000 after the state mandate for illegal aliens to be verified, or for all workers to be verified, wages went up by $5,000, which is a good boost to the average American worker.
And I think I remember those facts now, and I can confirm that what you're saying is accurate. What I'll say about the people that would ever criticize your position on holding back and reversing some of the ills of illegal and legal immigration is this. The only people that really want a proliferation of legal immigrants and illegal immigrants are the wealthy billionaire class in our country that own Microsoft and Facebook and the Silicon Valley companies, and as well some of the local smaller businesses that run construction companies, landscaping companies, et cetera, where they can exploit low wages. Now, I believe, as the president of Americans for Work and as an African-American attorney, that we're dealing with a vast and, unfortunately, racist corporate conspiracy, a conspiracy of billionaires and corporations that are both un-American and racist. They're un-American in that they would prefer to hire low-cost laborers from overseas and also hire illegal immigrants at a very low cost from down across the border.
You know, Tom, the only other group I'd throw in to that group, the two groups you just mentioned, is labor unions. Because I think the labor unions very much want to have the illegal alien workers here because they know that if they can organize them, and they usually are able to do that, that they can keep them into a – well, if they keep them in a very low-paid job, but they pay union wages, then the unions do well. And it also allows the unions to maintain their membership, which has been falling for the last few years. So I'd throw labor unions in there as well.
Unions could be a part of it, but I've been to a couple of commercial construction sites here in the Washington area recently, and frankly had a conversation with a probably 58-year-old Irish-American construction foreman. I won't use the word that he calls him. Illegal immigrants on construction sites across the country has devastated the construction worker class.
Tom Broadwire is the president of Americans for Work, talking about the Congress being on the cusp of mandating E-Verify for all American workers. We'll be back in just a moment with your phone calls and emails. 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarsen.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Rob writes in, Lars, New York City terror attack suspect, the FBI to scrub his PCN phones for terror connections. I hope it's not the same FBI crew that searched Hillary's computers and phones. I was going to add laugh out loud, but it's really not that funny. And he's very right about that. Let's go to naysayer Gary. Hey, Gary, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. You know how much we revere and adore naysayers on this program, don't you?
I do, actually, yes.
Okay. Go for it.
So the reason I'm calling, I don't usually agree with you, but I actually find you to be a pretty sensible person most of the time.
I try.
And that's why I listen to you.
Thank you.
But the reason I'm calling, I read your Facebook post last week, and you kind of referred to Al Franken as a molester, which I can't necessarily disagree with you if the allegations are true, but what I'm confused by is kind of your support of Roy Moore. Aside from the sexual allegations, I know you're a conservative. Mm-hmm. I know you're a Republican. Mm-hmm. But he said lots of awful things over the years. So far, let's see. I have some things written down. He said no.
Make sure they're accurate.
Office. They are. I'm not trying to BS anybody or joke around. But yes, mm-hmm. He said no Muslim should ever hold office. Drive-by shootings are due to evolution being taught in school because we teach kids that if they're animals and that's where they come from, that's how they'll act. Let's see. 9/11 occurred because our nation distanced itself from God, referred to the incident as divine punishment. Homosexual conduct should be illegal. He also said homosexuality is no different than bestiality in several interviews.
You're going to list off so many. I'm not going to be able to. I'm not going to be able to make a meaningful
okay,
reply
one
to
last
any of them.
One. Last week in a speech, he referred to Native Americans and Asians as reds and yellows. My question to you is, I know that you're a good Republican. I don't always agree with you, but I can't imagine Roy Moore winning a Senate seat is good for your party, and I'm kind of curious where his Christian values are, because I know your Christian values differ greatly from Roy Moore's.
Some of my values probably do differ, and in many cases, they're very much the same. I've actually expressed the thought that a real practicing Muslim who practices Sharia law, that Sharia is incompatible with constitutional government like we have here in America. And I've said that at least 100 times. So on that, I would agree with Moore about the difficult spot it puts you in if you really stand by your beliefs that Sharia law applies. I would agree with him. But he was actually making reference to Keith Ellison being sworn in to Congress about a decade
on the
ago.
Quran, correct?
Yeah, about a decade
yes,
ago.
I know what he's referring to.
Okay.
Yes. But you don't think homosexuality and bestiality are the same?
No, I don't. But I think that there are times where I've made comparisons saying, if you're going to say that certain things can be outlawed or cannot be outlawed, that you're going to get, some other consequences to that, because then you've opened yourself up to other kinds of comparisons that are going to be difficult to reject. So you got to be careful the basis on which you allow certain things to be said. But I guess this is all getting very convoluted. Roy Moore is who he is. He's going to be chosen, I think, tomorrow by the voters of Alabama. And the significant question isn't whether Lars Larson likes him or Gary likes him from Vancouver. The question is, do you think that if the people of a state choose somebody to represent them and they know about all of these complaints about his activities when he was in his 30s, when he may or may not have been dating teenage girls? I understand that recently he's actually given a full-throated denial that he dated teenage girls, but I'm not sure I'm convinced by that because he also gave a less than full-throated denial of it. So the question really is not whether or not the people of Alabama have a right to choose him. It's whether or not the Senate has a right to reject him as the choice from that state. And I think that's the critical question that I want to ask you. Do you think that the U.S. Senate should reject Roy Moore?
Yes.
Okay, then
absolutely. Then
let me ask you a question. Should the Senate have kicked Ted Kennedy out of the U.S. Senate? Because Roy Moore may have done a lot of terrible things. He never killed a girl, though, and Ted Kennedy did. We could also bring up Robert Byrd, whose past associations with the Klan. He was a recruiter for the Klan. Should he have been kicked out? Yes or no?
Yes.
Should Ted Kennedy have been kicked out?
Yes. To me, this isn't like a Democrat versus Republican.
I didn't say Democrat or Republican. I just gave you specific names.
Yes, but I know who they are. I mean, yes, I think people, if they're caught with their pants down or if they kill somebody accidentally, yeah, they probably shouldn't represent people all of America.
But in this case, it was Al Franken's colleagues who said he had to go, right?
And I think he should go, too. I like Al Franken, but I think what he did is bad, and I think that he should step down.
Can you tell me one significant good thing that Al Franken did for America?
I agreed with a lot of what he said.
No, tell me one significant thing that he did, a bill that he got passed, some change he made. He was there a decade. Did he do anything good for us?
I'm not 100% sure I can answer that question. I don't.
Then how can you draw the conclusion that he was a good guy if you can't name one good thing he did? Doing a lot of holiday shopping from your mobile devices, I'll tell you what, retailers expect 54% of holiday shoppers to visit their sites from a mobile device. Scammers see this as an opportunity to steal your credit card info and other personal data by distributing phony retail apps. Be cautious and only download the apps from reputable app stores and read the reviews for any complaints about malware. 1 in 4 people have experienced identity theft. If you're only monitoring your credit, your identity could be stolen in ways you may not detect. Thieves could sell your information on the dark web or get an online payday loan in your name. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats. If you've got a problem, U.S.-based restoration specialists will work to fix it. Nobody can prevent all identity theft or monitor every transaction at every business. LifeLock, though, can uncover threats you might miss. Join now and get 10% off with promo code LARS. Heck, I've had LifeLock for more than a decade. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK or go to LifeLock.com and use promo code LARS. That's LARS to save 10% today at LifeLock.com. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails. And on the phone with me right now is James Broll, who's a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. James, it's good to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time tonight.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, I never run out of stories, news stories, where liberals claim that through regulation, everything wonderful in life can be delivered, and that regulation makes everything in America better, and it saves lives. It makes babies smile. It makes rainbows appear on the horizon. And then I see a story like yours that says something more to my liking, which is regulation probably isn't that good an idea, and that in some cases, some regulations are literally killing people.
Right. So it's definitely true that lots of regulations aim to save lives. You know, there are definitely success stories from the past. I would say taking lead out of gasoline is probably an example of a policy that was successful and led to lives saved, you know, in the 1980s when that policy first began. But it's also true that regulations can increase the risk of death for various ways. In some cases, it's just kind of quirky, unintended consequences of specific regulations. So, for example, Fuel efficiency regulations have led to smaller cars on the road, which can be more dangerous in an accident. But the paper that I've written with my co-author, Kip Viscusi of Vanderbilt University, which was just published today, focuses on a more general way that regulations can increase the risk of death, and that's by reducing people's spending on health.
How's that? Okay, so explain for my audience that's listening. I think I know where you're headed with this, but how do regulations promulgated by state or federal government end up with people spending less money on health?
Sure. So regulations require often businesses to spend a lot of money on various things to comply with those regulations, you know, filling out paperwork or installing equipment or doing all kinds of different things, hiring new personnel. That reduces income to those companies, and it reduces income to the workers in that company, the owners of the company, and also to the customers who are going to face higher prices in the marketplace. All these compliance costs get passed through to real people. Somebody has to pay them. Their income falls, and some portion of that income would have been spent on health and improving their health and reducing risks of various kinds. So some of your income, for example, might go towards, you know, doctor's visits is a simple example, but it also might go towards living in a safer neighborhood, buying healthier food, paying for a gym membership, all kinds of things that would lead to a healthier lifestyle.
See, and James Broll is on the phone with me right now from George Mason University. You know, one of the things I think about is I just bought some new snow tires because I think we're heading into kind of a tough snow winter. You kind of have to guess because you don't know what it's going to be. But in my neck of the woods, it rains about 6 months of the year. And having a good set of tires on means I'm less likely to end up in an accident and end up dead. But if I'm stretched financially because of the cost of regulations, it may mean that I will stretch those old tires a little bit longer and let them get a little bit balder and let my family be put at a little bit greater risk because the money isn't there to buy the new set yet.
That's right. So there gets to be a point where a regulation could be so expensive that it reduces people's income by enough to actually increase risk. And so even regulations that aim to reduce mortality risk or reduce the risk of death might be so expensive that they actually increase the risk of death overall through this effect on health spending. And so my co-author and I estimate that every $99 million in regulatory expenditures, you can expect that to induce one death or kill one person in the population. So any regulation that costs more than $99 million per life saved will be so expensive that you can expect it to increase the risk of death and not reduce it. So you could actually expect it to kill more people than it saves.
Well, and in fact, I wonder, is there a way you can give me a practical example of something where it would cost $100 million or $99 million to be able to comply with something? And I guess one doesn't immediately jump to mind in my case. I guess you could talk about guardrails on freeways, but do you have a good example of something where they spend almost $100 million just to save one life?
Well, so we have a few examples in our paper. So, I mean, we look at about 9 air pollution regulations from the Environmental Protection Agency that have been issued over the last, you know, 7 or 8 years or so. Those regulations are expected to cost about $18.5 billion. And so that would translate into about 187 expected deaths. Now, according to the EPA, they will save far more lives than that. But there's also so much uncertainty surrounding the benefits of these regulations, and the costs are far more certain because we know that businesses are going to spend money complying. But recent studies have estimated there's so much uncertainty around these benefits that while our best estimate of the benefits of the regulations suggests they'll save more people than are killed from the regulations, there's actually so much uncertainty we can't be sure.
You know, I'm always suspicious, though, when they say if we adopt this regulation, for example, that restricts the amount of nitrous oxide or particulates that are given off by, you know, the operation of diesel engines in, you know, particular areas like the Los Angeles Basin or New York City, that by reducing the particulates that we figure for the for every 10 parts per billion that we'd reduce it, we're going to reduce so many cancers, of which a few will end up. How much of that stuff is just pure hocus pocus that you can't back up at all?
Well, one of the challenges with a lot of the recent air quality regulations from the EPA is that they all, for the most part, rely on this one particular pollutant being reduced for all for most of their benefits, and that's particulate matter, which you're talking about, which is basically little particles of dust in the air. And now there's evidence that there's a correlation between, you know, some between certain kinds of deaths and levels of this pollution. But there's a lot of uncertainty about whether it's a causal relationship. And also, we're, the levels of this pollutant are so low that they're actually below most of the studies and the evidence we actually have about how it makes people sick. So that's why one of the reasons why there's so much uncertainty about air quality regulations.
Yeah, because I listen, I understand what they're saying, that they somehow have calculated that for every given amount of pollution in the air, that it's going to create a certain number of cancers, and that a certain number of those cancers are likely to be fatal, and that it, you know, but I just wonder sometimes when they do this whether or not there's not a huge incentive, you know, since they're answering to government bureaucracies that want to justify new pollution requirements, that they're doing it with that in mind, and that if they actually said, well, even if you reduce pollution, I mean, because I'm to some extent, James, I'm thinking about the numbers they said. If once we get to 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide, the Earth will begin to inexorably warm. And we got to that number, and it doesn't appear to be happening. So, you know, so they changed the name from global warming to climate change to try to paper over that little mistake, because the number of 400 parts per million was not producing the effect they said it was going to.
So one of the big problems is that the regulatory agencies they produce the analysis alongside their own regulations. And so there's a strong incentive for them to make their own regulations look good.
Yeah.
It's kind of a conflict that happens. And so this is an issue that's been going back for years and years. It isn't one party or another.
James Brohl, research fellow at Mercatus Center at the George Mason University, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. But first, it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the program the man who once served as Secretary of the Air Force, General Tony McPeak. Your formal name is Merrill, but you go by Tony, don't you, General?
Yes, that's right, Lars. Thanks very much. I'm delighted to be here.
It is a pleasure to have you on the program, and thank you for your service in uniform over all those decades, from 1957 to 1994, and serving as Secretary of the Air Force and retiring as a four-star general from the United States Air Force. You've seen a lot in all those years, haven't you?
Well, I have. I've served all over the world. I spent 11 years in various NATO assignments in Europe. Of course, I spent my time in Vietnam. I commanded the Air Force in the Pacific for more than 2 years. And, of course, my last job was Chief of Staff in the Pentagon, the uniformed head of the Air Force. And during that period, there was a gap in our service secretary, as the Clinton administration came in, they had trouble, you know, making new appointments. And so I was a interim for a short term. I was an interim secretary. So I was my own boss for a while, the first uniformed officer that ever served as his own secretary.
Is that right? So that's never happened before. Why is that?
Never happened before. It has happened since. So I'm not anymore the only guy that ever did that, but I was the first uniformed person on active duty to serve as a service secretary simultaneously.
General McPeak, that raises an interesting side issue that I'd like to ask you about, and that is, I frequently hear from people that we'd be better off if we allowed people who had experience in uniform to be able to serve in those positions, because they know what they're asking of the men and women in uniform, and they know they have a greater knowledge of the nature of the tasks that they're undertaking. Would it make more sense if we made those the Secretary of the Air Force and Secretary of the Army, Secretary of the Navy positions to be held by people with some prior service in uniform?
Yeah, I think at least every once in a while it would be good to have an infusion of real-world experience in the, in the senior civilian ranks in the Pentagon. Frankly, Lars, I think it's more important to have some of that experience in Congress. You know, when I was a youngster growing up in the service, most congressmen and senators had served, it seemed like to me anyway, and there was almost a prerequisite for getting elected. The electorate checked the block. You know, did you serve in World War II or Korea or whatever? And now, of course, there's a very small number, a diminishing number, really, of people in either house of Congress who have any time in the foxhole whatsoever. And so I feel, you know, it would be better, really, and more necessary for the country to have some scar tissue over there of the kind you described.
No, and I think your argument is fantastic, although the numbers may be a problem. By the way, if you're listening, you're listening to General Tony McPeak, former Chief of Staff of the U.S. Air Force and the author most recently of Roles and Missions. I guess the only problem with that would be that the numbers that I know right now, and General, feel free to correct me, 9% of all Americans out of 330 million of us have either served in uniform, I have not, or are in uniform right now, which would mean that if we were choosing our elected leadership from only those who had prior military service, we'd only have about 9% of the U.S. population to choose from, and then only the ones of those who would choose to actually go out and fulfill a political role. And I think I have plenty of military friends and former military friends who say they wouldn't go anywhere near an elected office.
Well, that's an excellent point. Look, I'm not saying it should be a qualifying experience. Obviously, everybody in both houses doesn't need to have military service in their background. But I would be more comfortable if a larger fraction in there had some real-world hands-on experience in the military. And as I say, formerly, the percentage was pretty high. You know, 50-60% probably of our representatives and senators had done a military some military service. I think it's a pretty small fraction now, and I think that is a trend that's important to turn around. And by the way, not just military service, any kind of service of that kind, community service, Peace Corps. You know, I'm a big fan of some sort of national service for everybody, and people who want it should be in the military, you know, serve their term in the military. I think it would be a unifying factor in our society if we did have a system that sort of delayed you after high school. You spent a couple of years in service, and then you got, you know, something like the GI Bill to help with college expenses. That sort of thing, I think, would be good for the country.
I think that's a terrific idea, and you just have to work out the details. I do want to talk about your service, though, and I know that you talk about that in Roles and Missions, but you flew 269 combat missions in Vietnam. Now, how does that's got to be, you've got to be at nearly the top, if not the top, of the number of missions flown during that war.
No, I'm somewhere in the middle, probably.
Are you really?
As far as hardcore fighter pilots go. But many of those missions were into Laos under a secret program because we weren't supposed to be flying over there.
That's right.
My mission was to try to stop traffic down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. I don't know if you've seen the Ken Burns documentary that's been on public television here recently, the 10 episodes.
You were an advisor for that series, right?
I was an advisor for it, and I appear in 4 of the 10 episodes. But my appearance largely has to do with the Ho Chi Minh Trail and our effort to stop truck traffic down that trail. So I got a lot of flying time because those were long sorties, a couple of refuelings every time. Probably my actual combat flying time is fairly up on the scale there, but But 269 missions or so was pretty close to average for a year's worth of work over there.
General McPeak, tell me what you think about the idea of a secret mission like that, because I know that at the time when that was revealed, there were people who were outraged that how could we be doing this kind of thing in secret without the knowledge of the American public? And yet more recently, when President Obama put people not in uniform, but people, you know, fighting covertly in Syria before it was finally publicly revealed, I think an awful lot of people accepted that, well, that's the only way you're going to be able to fight something like that, that we have troops in places that Americans aren't even aware we have troops on the ground.
Yeah, I favor that second alternative. A lot of military operations should be and properly are classified and therefore not discussed publicly. This especially applies to units like Special Operations Forces, the SEAL Team 6 or the Delta Force that goes in to do something difficult and dangerous, usually on a temporary basis, a raid, go try to recapture some hostages, that kind of thing. The problem with the Laos operation was that it was only secret from the American people.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the Laotians knew we were over there bombing them, and so did the North Vietnamese who were trying to drive trucks down the trail. So it wasn't any secret. The reason it was classified was because the various administrations, Johnson, Nixon, et cetera, didn't want to be embarrassed about it. So I think we ought to be careful about what we classify and just face the facts. If we're trying to keep something quiet because we are embarrassed by it, that's not a good reason to classify anything. If it's to protect sources and methods, or if it's to protect a very risky military operation, then by all means it should be classified.
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm talking to General Tony McPeak, the author most recently of Roles and Missions. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you. And if you want to send an email, it's talk@larslarson.com. Our website is absolutely solid, larslarson.com. In fact, the IT team did a very good job of rebuilding it just shortly, a little while ago. I'm talking to retired General Tony McPeak, a former chief of staff of the U.S. Air Force and the author of Roles and Missions. We were talking about Vietnam, and I wouldn't mind going back to that in a moment, but I want to get your take on what's going on between the United States and North Korea, because we've seen 25 years or so of negotiation with North Korea, and we were told by successive administrations, Clinton, then Bush, then Obama, saying, yeah, we can talk the crazy man, both the father and the son in North Korea, out of nuclear weapons and out of ballistic missiles. And after 25 years of talking, we now have what appears to be a nuclear-armed North Korea rapidly approaching the date where they can drop an intercontinental ballistic missile on Washington, D.C. So, General, what do you think we ought to do there?
Well, first of all, Lars, let's put it in context. In my opinion, this is the most important international security problem that we face in the world today.
Agreed.
There are a number of important problems. Don't get me wrong. Iran's nuclear program is a problem. What we're going to do in the Middle East more generally is a problem,
mm-hmm.
et cetera. So there's lots of other problems. But if you rank them, this is the one that must be number one, because most of the problems we face can damage us if we make a mistake. But this one is virtually an existential threat to the country. I don't want to see Seattle or Los Angeles or Chicago or indeed Portland be evaporated by some crazy person in North Korea. So we have to solve this problem. This is not a voluntary situation for us. This is mandatory. We have to get to the bottom of this. Now, what should we do? Well, I favor anything short of military action if it works. I mean, let's negotiate. Let's lean on the Chinese to try to get them to help, and the Russians, try to get them to help.
Mm-hmm.
Let's impose economic sanctions. I mean, everything short of direct military intervention, let's try it. But my opinion is we have tried most of that stuff so far, and it hasn't worked. Therefore, I think what's probably likely to happen here is we're going to have to intervene militarily. And the real question is, how long have we got? because I feel we have seen remarkable progress being made on the Korean side, North Korean side. They're improving their systems capabilities much faster than we thought they could. It's now clear that they have both nuclear munitions, high-yield munitions, and the capability to deliver them at some intercontinental range.
Mm-hmm.
The remaining problem they have is avionics, that is, guidance. Can they actually hit what they're aiming at in the end game? And can they survive atmospheric reentry with the warhead?
Yep.
These are hard problems, and they may take a while to solve, but they're not insolvable, and they won't take forever. In my judgment, we have about 6 to 12 months in which we can figure out what to do here. And we ought to begin by saying to the North Koreans, you must dismantle this program under international inspection, and you must dismantle it by such and such a date, let's say next Christmas, just to name a date. And if you don't dismantle it by next Christmas, or if we don't have an agreement to do that, we will help dismantle that program. Now, that is a threat that we should make immediately, and we should be serious about.
You know, General, you're the first person that I've heard actually say that, and I'm glad that you have the "or else," because everyone else who talks to me about this seems to stop with the "we're going to tell them to stop doing it." And I always ask them, "Well, or else what?" And the "or else" is "or else we'll do something." Well, no, but if you spell out for them what you're going to do, as you just did, and say, if you don't do it, we will help dismantle it for you. Two side issues, and let me ask you about them. Number one, their rapid progress on the avionics side of this, the guidance side of this. Do you think that's perhaps because of all the technology that was given away in the 1990s by the Clinton administration to the Chinese? Because a lot of people have forgotten that there was a huge scandal at the time over Loral and some of the avionics that went into China. And we all said we're gonna rue the day that this stuff got away from us. And of course, the Chinese, while they are officially against what North Korea is doing, I think they like North Korea being antagonistic toward the United States. Is it possible that the North Koreans are progressing that rapidly, not because they have really smart folks on their team, but because they have really good sources of technology in China?
Well, I think it's possible, Lars, but I don't know. I can't confirm that. I really don't think it makes any difference. From our point of view, they will develop the capability to aim the munitions and guide them to the target.
Mm-hmm.
That's only a question of time.
All right.
Is it a year? Is it 2 years? Who helps them with that? I don't care. The issue is we have to stop that program before they can really do it. I mean, I don't want to see Seattle go up in smoke. So it's just now. I do think that we have the conventional capability to stop this program by attacking infrastructure and by attacking Pyongyang, attacking the leadership.
Well, General, let me ask you something. If you, in anticipating some kind of attack on the specific strategic sites that we have to take out to denuclearize North Korea, wouldn't you assume that we would simultaneously carry out an air bombardment of the entire north side of the DMZ diminish? Or is that just too much to hope for, that you could effectively take out most of their capability, those big howitzers that are pointed towards Seoul?
Yeah, look, I used to command the Air Force in the Pacific, including our units in Korea.
Yes, sir.
So I spent a lot of time working on this problem. These guns are tunneled into the hills with blast doors protecting them. They're on a rail, so they roll them out, shoot the gun, roll them back in, close the doors, rearm, reload, roll them back out. They are extremely difficult, hard targets. And ultimately, the way to stop that is to go in on the ground, take charge of that real estate. So from the very beginning, we would work on this target set. You can't do it with dumb bombs because the miss distance, of 100 meters that you can sort of predict for dumb bombs is not good enough to take those guns out. You have to hit the blast doors pretty precisely. So that means a precision-guided munition against each of those artillery sites, and there are, like I say, thousands of them. So it's not a question of can we hit them. We can. But it just takes time to service that target set and properly knock each of those guns out. Now, I'm not talking about a year to do it, but certainly weeks to take, you know, some days certainly to take out that target set. And in the meantime, Seoul gets pretty badly beat up, and there's really nothing you can do about it.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get back to your calls a bit later in the program. But my guest is General Tony McPeak, a former chief of staff of the U.S. Air Force and the author most recently of Roles and Missions. Now, there's a description of you that has that you are hawkish on North Korea, which you and I were just talking about, but dovish on the Middle East. Is that an accurate description? And if so, why are you described that way, General?
Well, let's say I was dovish in the early years of this century after the after George W. Bush's election and after he decided to take on Iraq II.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was in the JCS. I was chief of the Air Force during Desert Storm. And I thought we had magnificent leadership in the present person of George H.W. Bush, Jim Baker over at State Department, Dick Cheney, SecDef, Colin Powell as chairman. And we did Desert Storm properly. We limited the action. We expelled the Iraq forces from Kuwait. We did the job. But I wouldn't have advocated even then wheeling around and trying to drive up to Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
And replace Saddam Hussein. I thought, you know, limited war, we got it done, and good, let's get out of here. But Iraq II was deliberately aimed at replacing, removing Saddam Hussein, and the justification for it was phony, in my opinion. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Saddam was not a good friend of Osama bin Laden. In fact, they were sworn enemies. One thing you can say about Saddam, there wasn't any al-Qaeda in Iraq as long as he was around.
That's true.
I didn't think we were going to be welcomed. You know, bouquets were going to be thrown at us by, we weren't going to be welcomed as liberators and so forth. So all that rationale was phony. And I opposed Iraq too. And our subsequent occupation of that country has been a disaster, a $1 trillion disaster for us. So that's why I might be characterized as dovish on the Middle East. I am hawkish on North Korea. And by the way, Saddam never constituted any kind of a existential threat to us. He was a regional player at best. Now we got a guy who's a crazy person in Pyongyang who represents a threat to major U.S. cities.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different deal. And so don't blame me or don't say I'm inconsistent here. The circumstances are different. I think we must take action to disarm the North Koreans from their nuclear capabilities. Must do it. And that kind of rationale was never available for anything we did in the Middle East.
Well, and one of the big concerns I've got, you mentioned on going back to the missile technology they're developing, that they have the bomb, but they may not have one that is sufficiently miniaturized to put it on the missile that they now have, which is the last one they tested just recently, would have had the kind of range to reach Washington, D.C. Maybe not tremendously accurate, but I think in what is it? Close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. In nuclear weapons, I don't think close is more than good enough. And one of the things I worry about is you mentioned the heat shield, which I hear a lot of people mention. But what I worry about is the North Koreans read about, you know, about some of the early tests that the United States did, and they say, we don't need that bomb to re-enter. We need it to be launched up in the, you know, up in the atmosphere and to go off 30 or 40 or 50 miles above the west coast of America, and all the lights go out on the west coast permanently, and millions of people die. You don't have to actually hit a city with the nuke if you turn out all the lights.
Yep. No, I agree. That's a very convincing scenario, sort of some sort of electronic pulse of that kind that's associated with nuclear detonations would not just put out, you know, big chunks of electricity, but also a lot of our intelligence capability. And maybe things like GPS wouldn't work. And a lot of our military capability now depends on these satellite systems that could come under attack of the kind you described.
So hey, General, I agree with you. General, in the last few minutes we've got, I want you to address this. There's a case to be made that the United States military was considerably degraded in its performance during the 8 years of President Obama, that funding was cut, that we now have a Navy that's as small as the Navy we had around the time of World War I, and that our military is considerably smaller. Now, I understand with modern technology and modern methods that we can get by perhaps with, you know, we don't necessarily have to have a 500,000 people in uniform or a couple of million like China has. But do we need to make a considerable investment in our military to get it back up to snuff for the 21st century?
I think there are selective areas where we need much increased investment. And one of them, by the way, is ballistic missile defense. It's a disgrace that we sit here today, you know, 50 years after or so. Ronald Reagan was talking about Star Wars, right?
Which people degraded or they disparaged as Star Wars. But in fact, it's technology that we have figured out how to make a bullet hit a bullet, right?
Exactly. And with the fact that we stand essentially defenseless against this attack by this crazy guy in North Korea, we should already have robust defenses and dependable defenses for this country. We do have a thin shield of defense, which I don't regard as reliable enough to defend, you know, to take a chance. So that's an area where we need much increased expenditures. I think a separate problem is we need to reform our armed forces. We're dragging around way too much logistics tail now. So a lot of the dollars that are going into the defense budget don't really provide us with combat capability, but they provide us with the infrastructure, you know, motor pools, supply warehouses, depots, et cetera. And some of that, a lot of it needs to be streamlined drastically. A lot of it has a big political clout, though.
By the way, General, just so we don't slip past that too fast, if I'm not incorrect, you're referring to the fact that when you talk about closing a big base that may not be necessary in today's military era, that you've got congressmen or senators from that state who say, oh, no, you can't close that base, not because we need it for military purposes, but because it's good for the surrounding communities in that congressman's state.
Yeah, I've got scar tissue on top of my other scar tissue from closing a couple of big bases where the issue was payroll in Sacramento, you know, or
like McClellan.
McClellan, I'm the guy that closed McClellan. As it's really not ever closed, but I shut down the Air Force Depot at McClellan. And I've got the marks on my back yet from the politics of that, but a lot more of that kind of thing has to be done, so that we can finance the real fighting, the tooth part of the tooth to tail ratio. The tooth part is run down, in my opinion, doesn't have strong enough personnel or material support. And one way to solve that is throw more money at the Pentagon. But another way is to insist that the Pentagon be more effective in producing actual hardcore defense.
General Tony McPeak, who did all those decades of service for the United States of America. He is the author most recently of Roles and Missions. And if you've seen Ken Burns' documentary about Vietnam, his landmark series on PBS, General McPeak served for years as an advisor on that. General, it is a pleasure to have you on. Congratulations on the book, Roles and Missions, and we appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Lars. It's been great talking to you, buddy.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. To your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. And we go to naysayers first. Brian's on the line in Tacoma. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about?
Thank you. Actually, I'm having a hard time not switching subjects based on what you just talked about with Brian Ross. But
no.
I'll stick to what I called
about. Go ahead.
I'll stick to what I called about. In regards to the Seattle City Light, my wife and I have been trying to close my recently deceased mother-in-law's AT&T account for months and months and months, and we just can't make any headway. AT&T is a private business, and you're just sort of right now spouting out the classic Republican go-to, where you rail on government, but for the exact same issue, you give private business a pass.
Can I tell you why there's a big difference?
Sure, please.
All right. Here's my theory. I frequently get angry with private companies that don't do what they promise to do. And do you know what I do after I get angry with them? I stop doing business with them. In other words, I've had contractors that I have done business with for years, and then when they screw up badly enough or they misrepresent something and they don't deliver what they promised to deliver, I say, I don't want to do business with you anymore. Do you know why you can't do that with government?
Why?
If you get mad at AT&T, how many other phone companies can you do business with easily that are major phone companies?
It depends where you live and what utility you're talking about.
But at least you have more than one company that you can choose from. If I decide that I'm unhappy with Seattle City Light and I no longer want to do business with them, I no longer want to buy electricity with them, what alternative do I have? Look, Brian, I don't mind people asking me anything, but I'm asking you a question. If I don't like Seattle City Light, what other alternative do I have?
Actually, you could move, which you Republicans.
If I get mad at Verizon and I don't want to do business with them anymore, I don't have to move to another jurisdiction to be able to do business with a different phone company. But if I don't like Seattle City Light, do I have any alternative to buy electricity somewhere else?
I'm not buying it. I mean, I get your argument, but you're telling me that I have over two options or three options of these private businesses that get away with stealing my money and screwing me over. You're saying if I switch to the next one and all things, what if all things are not good then, which they're not, because the companies have written the rules at the behest of the Republican.
Hold on. You think AT&T wrote its rules because the Republican Party told AT&T how to write its rules? Come on.
Sorry,
they wrote their rules to get customers.
Did you hear me just switch? I said I think lobbyists of both shades, you know. So you're saying that the rules are made in place.
Brian, I don't hold people through very often, but I'd like to hear your argument for why you think I'm wrong to fault government when in most of the cases, almost all cases, if you don't like the way the government operates, you don't have any alternatives. But if you don't like the way a private business is operating, you have lots or at least a few alternatives to go to.
Well, I'd like to make a sort of larger point about being a liberal person, which, as you can tell, I am.
Oh, God bless you, because without people like you, I would probably be jobless and penniless. So thank God for people like you, Brian.
Possibly, yeah. So it's the frustrating part for me is I think conservatives generally think that I, as a liberal, think the government works wonderfully, and I love it all the time, and I want free stuff from it all the time. That's 100% not true. I generally think it works horribly. I don't want free stuff. I want to pay in and then get stuff because I paid in, and I want it to work better than it does. But my answer is we need it. We need roads. We need police forces. We need prisons. We need so on and so forth. And so
you've just named off all the things that you and I would agree on in terms of government. But here's the difference. The reason my philosophy says that government is terrible at doing most things is that government has no competition. Now, if you ask, should we have a competition in the military, we actually do have competition in the military, Brian. Right within the sound of your voice and my voice right now is the Bangor submarine base, right? I've had the pleasure of going out on one of those Ohio-class subs, and unless they've changed things since I got a chance to go out on a ride on one of them, and that was a couple of decades ago, they have a blue crew and a gold crew. And what do they do with those two crews? They make them compete against each other. And you say, well, how do you compete when you're in a military unit? Well, you have one crew take the sub out for 90 to 130 days, and they're out there doing their jobs, and they run drills for proficiency. And when they get back, they compare their numbers for the blue crew to the gold crew. And as I understand it, the one that gets the better, you know, ratings in terms of the ability to do their job efficiently and accurately gets a little extra time off, or they get some kind of, you know, some kind of bonus out of it, right? And by doing it that way, by making them compete against each other, they get a better product. Do you know anywhere else where the government does that?
The government does have competition.
Where?
Oh, it's supposed to.
Where?
It's supposed to.
Well, it is not. If you wanted that kind of competition, you know what you'd do? You'd go out and you say, Seattle Department of Transportation could say to its crews. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, government does have competition. It's supposed to, designed by the framers of the Constitution. It's supposed to have voting them out and getting a next set of people that you agree with it.
No, that's not competition. You know, Brian, this is probably why you're a liberal. You seem to think the competition is that that America would have one cell phone company, and if we didn't like it, we'd have to put up with it for 4 years, and every 4 years or every 6 years, we'd get to vote the bad cell phone company out and get the new cell phone company in. What real competition is where you're offered both or all the cell phone options at the same time, and you get a chance to make real-time choices. You can say, to blazes with you, T-Mobile, I'm going down the street to Verizon, or I'm going down to AT&T. But having one politician do a bad job, and then you get to vote him out after 2 years or 4 years or 6 years and vote a different one in and see if he works out any better? That's not competition. I appreciate the call, though, Brian. You were a superior naysayer, and as a liberal, I think you got all the liberal good stuff going for you. I mean, and God bless you. Like I said, without you, I'd be in trouble. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.